Right now, there is a former U.S. senior official who has legally registered a corporate shell company with one specific singular purpose.
Right.
And that purpose is to buy the future remains of TikTok. I mean, think about that for a second.
It's pretty wild to consider.
It really is. It's basically the equivalent of like a neighbor legally registering a moving company and then parking this massive truck on your front lawn explicitly to take your house.
Before you've even put it up for sale.
Exactly, before you've even considered putting a for sale sign in the yard.
Yeah. And it perfectly captures the unprecedented nature of this whole situation. We are watching an event that has jurists, technologists, and global politicians entirely captivated.
Oh, for sure.
And not just because of the cultural impact of the app, right? But because of the raw mechanics of this massive wealth and power transfer that's being proposed.
Welcome to another deep dive.
Yeah.
If you are joining us today, you are likely trying to make sense of a massive, paradigm-shifting global headline.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
And you want to do it without, drowning in a sea of legislative jargon or political grandstanding. You want the actual mechanics behind the curtain.
The real gears turning in the background.
Right. So today, we are focusing our entire analysis on a single, incredibly dense and fascinating source. We're looking at a comprehensive interview conducted by Phoenix Financial for their program Cover.
Great interview, by the way.
It really is. They sat down with Taojing Zhu, who is a highly respected international independent arbitrator, to discuss the U.S. president signing the TikTok divestment bill.
Now, before we dive into the architecture of this event, I really want to establish a clear boundary for you, the listener.
Yeah, this is important.
Because this specific topic is, inherently tangled up with complex geopolitics, sovereign national security definitions, and really intense legal disputes.
Right, it gets heated fast.
It does. So our deep dive today will strictly and impartially report on the perspectives and the legal realities shared in the source material. We're examining the structural arguments of an international arbitrator. We are not here to take a political side or, endorse any specific national policy or weigh in on the ideologies involved.
Right.
Our mission is strictly analytical.
We are dissecting the chessboard, not rooting for a specific king.
I like that.
And our mission today is to move way past that simple, overused surface debate of will it be banned or will it be sold?
Right, because it's so much deeper than that.
Exactly. Instead, we want to uncover the underlying legal strategies being deployed, the actual judicial mechanics of the surprisingly long timeline ahead.
Which a lot of people are misunderstanding.
Oh, completely. And finally, we'll look at why international legal experts believe this specific case marks the definitive end of the flat global village, ushering in a highly fractured, localized digital world.
It's a huge shift.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Well,
let's start with that moving truck on the lawn, the ghost buyer we mentioned.
right, the shell company.
Yeah, everyone just assumes TikTok is backed into a corner where they either completely shut down U.S. operations or they capitulate and sell to an American entity. But legally speaking, how viable is simply refusing the sale? Can they just say no?
Well, refusing is not just viable, it is actually their immediate primary strategy.
Wait, really?
Yeah. And it's anchored by a formidable legal shield, which is the First Amendment.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, Taojing Zhu explains the mechanics of this defense in the interview, and it fundamentally changes the nature of the dispute. TikTok's defense strategy isn't built around corporate ownership rights.
Right.
It's built around freedom of speech. They're arguing that a forced acquisition or a ban basically operates as a prior restraint on the free expression of their company.
And their users, right? Like 170 million US users.
Exactly, all of those users.
Because in the eyes of the law, algorithmic curation-like, the way the app decides what video to show you next has actually been established as a form of editorial speech.
That is the absolute crux of the argument. And when the government attempts to regulate or, suppress that kind of speech, the courts apply a legal standard known as strict scrutiny.
Okay, strict scrutiny. What does that mean in practice?
Well, under strict scrutiny, the burden of proof violently shifts onto the government.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, legislators can't simply cite a hypothetical or generalized fear about data security to override fundamental free speech protections.
So they have to prove a concrete imminent threat. Like they have to show the court the actual smoking gun, not just argue that a gun theoretically exists somewhere in the building.
Precisely. That's a great way to put it. The source points out that TikTok will demand the U.S. government definitively prove actual infringement on user privacy
Right.
or, actual misuse of personal data
Yeah.
or an actualized threat to national security.
Yeah, if they can't.
Well, if the government's case relies just on the potential for future harm based on, say, foreign ownership, that First Amendment shield becomes incredibly difficult to pierce in a courtroom.
Right, because potential harm isn't enough to squash free speech. But the interview doesn't just stop at the constitutional defense, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Tao Jingzhu outlines a secondary, highly technical defense involving corporate equity. And I really want to get into the mechanics of this, because it sounds like they could fundamentally alter the DNA of the company,
Yes, they could.
like legally bypass the divestment order without actually selling the platform to that ghost buyer waiting in the wings. So how does an equity restructuring satisfy a forced sale?
So when we talk about corporate equity in this specific context, we need to separate financial payout from operational control.
Okay.
Right now, the core legislative demand is about severing the perceived direct or indirect control of the platform by a foreign sovereign government.
Right, the control aspect.
Yeah. And Tao notes that the current ownership entity doesn't actually hold a massive monopolistic amount of equity in that specific, highly scrutinized regard anyway.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's already a mixed pool of global investors.
Okay, so they essentially build a firewall.
Yeah.
They restructure the company so that foreign entities keep their financial shares, meaning they still reap the economic benefits of the platform's success, but they completely surrender their voting shares.
Or their board seats, exactly, to a localized American trust.
That's wild. So you detach the financial cord from the steering wheel.
That is the exact mechanism of the structural defense, yes. If they can definitively demonstrate to the courts and regulators that they've cut off any potential avenue for foreign governmental control over the data architecture and the algorithm.
Then they might actually satisfy the core demands of the
Yeah,
legislation.
exactly. They essentially argue, look, we have divested the control, which neutralizes the stated national security threat,
Right.
making a forced sale of the financial asset an extreme and unnecessary overreach.
Which honestly makes the existence of that ghost buyer even more fascinating to me.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it tells us that despite these massive constitutional and structural firewalls, highly connected people still believe those shields are going to fail.
Yeah, they're betting on it.
Right. And Tao Jingzhu points out that we simply don't know if this official has a reasonable expectation based on, insider political momentum, or if it's just whimsical anticipation.
Right, a billion-dollar whim.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the mere fact that billions of dollars are being organized in the shadows shows that this is a massive wealth and power transfer waiting for a legal crack to form.
What's fascinating here is that that anticipation brings us to probably the most misunderstood aspect of this entire geopolitical event.
The timeline,
The clock,
right?
yeah.
Because people see the headline, President signs bill, and they just panic.
They think it's over.
Are you worried this app is going to disappear from your phone tomorrow?
Yeah.
Because people assume the app is going dark at midnight.
Right.
But signing the bill doesn't end the fight. It just geographically relocates it. It moves the battleground from the legislative branch to the judicial branch.
Exactly.
The clock doesn't start on a ban today. It starts a marathon of injunctions, discovery phases, and appellate court hearings. So, based on the source, how long are we actually looking at here?
Well, Tao Jingzhu provides a very necessary reality check on this timeline.
Okay.
We are looking at a process that will almost certainly outlast the current political cycle.
Wow.
Yeah. The initial signing of the bill triggers lawsuits, which immediately trigger requests for preliminary
Which
injunctions.
is essentially asking a judge to pause the ban while the legality is debated, right?
Precisely. And from there, it has to move through the lower courts, up through the appellate circuits, and culminating in an inevitable unconstitutionality review at the U.S. Supreme Court.
But let me push back on how bulletproof that timeline is.
Okay, go ahead.
We know this takes years. And in that time, we will have a new presidential administration. Regardless of the Supreme Court's ultimate unconstitutionality review, couldn't a future Department of Justice simply choose to interpret the law differently?
That's a fair question.
Or, quietly deprioritize the enforcement of the divestment? Because we've seen incoming administrations drop the legal pursuits of their predecessors before.
We have. It's a strategic question, definitely. But the source indicates that the political momentum, and especially the bipartisan nature of this specific legislation, make a quiet DOJ dismissal highly improbable.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, the true final arbiter here is inescapable, and that's the Supreme Court. And what Tao emphasizes is the static nature of that ultimate ruling body. While administrations turn over, the ideological math of the court is locked.
The source specifically points to the current makeup of the court to illustrate this, right?
Yes, he does. Tao specifically notes the recent corruption allegations surrounding Justice Clarence Thomas as a variable some people are watching.
Right, there's been in the news a lot.
Exactly. However, his analysis concludes that the likelihood of Justice Thomas actually resigning over these allegations is exceedingly small.
So no sudden changes there.
Right. The court's composition, and therefore its ideological approach to strict scrutiny and national security deference, will almost certainly remain static throughout this whole multi-year appellate process.
Wow.
So when those nine justices finally issue their ruling, it is the absolute unalterable final result. There's no higher authority.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. If the Supreme Court eventually sides with the government, like, if they uphold this legislation and legally establish that a nation can unilaterally dismantle or force the sale of a foreign-owned communications platform operating within its borders.
Just by citing a broad, generalized national security risk.
Exactly. Doesn't that immediately hand a loaded weapon to every other country on Earth?
Yes. That is the exact alarm bell To Jingzhu is ringing in the interview.
It has to be.
The international precedent this sets is just staggering. He warns that this legislation opens the door wide for global reciprocal retaliation.
Right, tit for tat.
Exactly. Other countries, particularly those with what he describes as less sound legal systems, they'll look at this U.S. precedent and realize they no longer need to navigate complex regulatory frameworks.
Oh, I see. They can just point to the U.S. and say, well, they did it.
Right. They can simply issue an immediate executive mandate to shut down American tech companies operating within their borders using the exact same justification in sovereign national security.
It essentially provides a legally sanitized playbook for protectionism. Like, if the loudest champion of free markets can do it to us, we can do it to them.
Precisely. And to illustrate just how far outside the norm this divestment bill is within broader Western legal traditions, Tao actually contrasts the U.S. approach with France.
Okay, how does France handle it?
Well, if the French government identified a serious issue with an American tech giant regarding data privacy, or, say, algorithmic harm, their legal framework dictates a process of enforcement, not existential execution.
Enforcement meaning?
Meaning they would levy massive financial penalties, or they demand rigorous compliance audits, or mandate specific localized structural rectifications.
So they use a scalpel, not a wrecking ball.
Exactly.
They force the company to behave. They don't force the company to be sold to a French billionaire.
That's a perfect analogy. And this shift from the scalpel to the wrecking ball, it signals a much deeper structural change in how human beings are going to interact with technology globally.
Which brings us to a concept that completely rewired how I view my own devices after reading this source.
Yeah.
Yeah. For the last 20 or 30 years, the prevailing, undisputed narrative was Thomas Friedman's idea that technology was making the Earth flat.
Right, the flat earth theory of globalization.
Exactly, the idea that the internet was erasing physical borders, democratizing access to information, and just pulling the entire globe into one unified, interconnected global village.
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, Tao Jingzhu argues that this era is definitively over.
The flat earth is dead.
Yeah. The metaphor he uses in the interview is profound. He says the earth is no longer flat. Because of these new, insurmountable technological and legal walls, the world has become a rugged, hilly terrain.
A hilly terrain.
Yes. He describes the emerging global landscape as bumpy.
Bumpy. I love that word for it. But let's look at the actual mechanics of a bumpy digital terrain. Because this isn't just about, you know, different apps being popular in different countries. We're talking about the physical and infrastructural splintering of the internet.
What some call the splinternet.
Yes, the splinternet.
That is exactly what a hilly terrain looks like in practice. It is the literal reshaping of globalization. What we're observing isn't an isolated dispute over short-form video.
Right.
It is the blueprint for how the world fractures back into distinct, insulated geopolitical interest blocks. The source suggests we're seeing the formation of a Western digital camp, a developing nation camp, and others.
So within those specific blocks, the technology integrates seamlessly.
Right.
But between the blocks, you have entirely separate undersea cables, redundant domestic server farms, incompatible hardware protocols, and strict data localization laws.
Exactly.
The hills are literal physical and legal barricades that stop data from crossing a border.
It's the systemic, deliberate disconnection of regions from one another, We are essentially using the law to permanently divide the digital earth.
Which really forces us to confront the philosophical core of the source material. We have to look at the internal justification for this.
Let's do it.
Because I want to push back on behalf of the legal scholars and the netizens mentioned in the text.
Okay.
By redefining national security so broadly that it encompasses, you know, hypothetical future data misuse by a social media app.
Yeah.
Doesn't this bill represent a massive, undeniable regression for the United States' commitment to the rule of law?
That is one of the fiercest debates currently raging among legal scholars. And Tao Jingzhu impartially outlines the mechanics of both sides in the interview.
Okay, let's hear the sides.
Let's examine the first perspective, the regression argument. Many scholars firmly believe this is a dangerous step backward, precisely because of the definitional expansion you just mentioned.
Yeah, the stretch of the definition.
Exactly. When you stretch national security far beyond its traditional definable legal boundaries, which are traditionally military or critical infrastructure threats, and apply it to consumer software algorithms.
You create a limitless legal loophole.
Yes.
Right? Because if a consumer dance app is classified as a national security threat, the legal definition becomes so elastic that it can be wrapped around virtually any foreign-owned business.
Exactly. It removes the predictability that the rule of law completely relies upon. However, the text clearly presents the counterargument to the due process perspective.
Okay, what's their take?
Other legal scholars argue that this is absolutely not a regression because the validity of the rule of law is defined by adherence to process, not by the permissiveness of the outcome.
So as long as the machinery of the republic is used correctly, the law remains intact.
That's the argument. To make this distinction concrete, the text provides a stark contrast with India.
Right, the India comparison.
A few years ago, the Indian government identified Chinese apps like WeChat and TikTok as security risks, and they banned them overnight.
Overnight.
Wow. Yes, they accomplished this through a single, sudden executive command.
So there was no structural defense, no strict scrutiny, just a switch being flipped off by the state.
Right. But the U.S. approach, as the source notes, has been the exact antithesis of a sudden decree.
True.
This divestment legislation has been debated publicly for years. It required transparent legislative processes, committee markups, open floor debates, and votes in both the House and the Senate.
All while absorbing intense, highly funded lobbying from interest groups on both sides.
Exactly. The argument here is that the U.S. government did not arbitrarily seize an asset. They utilized the textbook democratic legislative process to regulate a perceived threat.
So what does this all mean? The law functioned exactly as designed, even if the resulting legislation fundamentally alters the global free market. When you zoom out and synthesize everything we've covered today, the First Amendment battles requiring strict scrutiny, the multi-year Supreme Court appellate timelines, the structural equity firewalls, and, you know, the transition from a flat earth to a localized bumpy splinter net.
It's a lot.
It is. But it highlights a profound tragedy that Tao Jingzhu points out at the end of the interview.
It really is a tragedy of stalled potential. Ideally, humanity should be moving forward collectively.
Yeah.
We should be leveraging these incredible borderless new technologies to elevate the global population simultaneously, sharing advancements in real time.
But instead, we are weaponizing legal frameworks to build technological barricades.
Exactly.
These localized digital hills mean that some nations will continue to advance rapidly within their tightly integrated walled gardens, while others will be forced to stall.
Completely cut off from the global flow of innovation and communication.
The tragedy isn't just about who owns a specific app. It's about the deliberate, legally mandated splintering of human progress.
We are watching the primary unifier of the last three decades be transformed into the primary mechanism for geopolitical division.
It is a massive shift in the human story. Well, we have covered an immense amount of ground today. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.
It's been fascinating.
If you've been listening, you now possess a comprehensive grasp of the TikTok divestment bill that goes far beyond the sensational binary headlines. You understand the mechanics of the First Amendment shield, the strategic equity firewalls being built, the glacial reality of the appellate process.
Which will take years.
Exactly. Oh. And most importantly, how this single legal battle serves as the catalyst for reshaping global trade and connectivity.
And as we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, building directly on Tao Jingzhu's powerful metaphor.
Let's hear it.
We explored the definitive end of the flat global village and the rapid physical rise of a hilly, fractured technological landscape. If the future of global digital products requires navigating these steep, highly localized digital hills, drastically differing legal systems, incompatible hardware protocols, and competing definitions of national security, how will the next generation of innovators ever manage to design a product for the whole world?
Yeah.
Will the very concept of a global app, a single universal platform that everyone on Earth uses to connect, regardless of borders, simply become a relic of a bygone, flatter past?
That forces you to look at the icons on your phone in a completely different light. They aren't just appliances. They might be artifacts from a unified digital era that is already closing. Keep questioning the structures around you, keep looking past the surface-level narratives, and we look forward to going on our next deep dive together soon.